Sri Krish Gopalakrishnan is a co-founder and former co-chairman of Infosys. Recognized as a global business and technology thought leader, he was voted the top CEO in IT services in Institutional Investor's inaugural ranking of Asia top executives. He was also selected to Thinkers 50, an elite list of global business thinkers in 2009. He was elected President of India's Apex Industry Chamber, the Confederation of Indian Industry, in 2013-14, and served as one of the co-chairs of the World Economic Forum in Davos in January 2014. He was awarded with Padma Bhushan, the country's third highest civilian honor by Government of India in 2011. One of India's most accomplished and celebrated entrepreneurs, he holds master's degrees in physics and computer science from IIT Madras. Presently, he is the chairman of Axela Ventures, a startup accelerator and venture fund. Also, he is the chairman of International Institute of Information Technology, Bangalore. Today, Sri Krish Gopalakrishnan will be sharing his perspectives on emerging technologies and their relevance for Indian Navy.
Vice Admiral A.K. Chawla, officers of Indian Navy, guests, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to share my thoughts and broaden my presentation to talk about perspectives on emerging technologies. And you will see that as I proceed, there is a lot of interconnection between emerging technologies and one of the emerging technologies being artificial intelligence. During COVID times, we have seen an acceleration of adoption of digital, and all of us have become more dependent on digital technologies. For example, you know, I'm making this presentation sitting in Bangalore, and all of you are dispersed across various parts of the country, and still you are able to hear, see, and interact in real time. And this acceleration has happened suddenly with the crisis that happened, the necessity that has happened. Of course, we want to plan the use of technology, and that is what I will talk about in my presentation. The outline is, I will start with a long view of the impact of emerging technologies. And the reason for this is, you know, we need to understand the way other countries are approaching this, how they have taken advantage of this long view and a systematic way in which to leverage emerging technologies. Then I will quickly jump into an overview of emerging technologies, not in terms of each and every technology and the details of that, but understanding better why that emerging technology is highly relevant to us. The underlying power of that emerging technology and why it's so impactful. Then I will touch upon applicability of AI in the naval context, and conclude by talking about, again, based on my perspective, my understanding of how businesses, organizations look at emerging technologies, and looking at my understanding of how other countries have approached this, how do we look at a strategy for emerging, leveraging emerging technologies. So let's quickly jump in. Now, this is the view of GDP, global GDP, over the last 200 years, actually. And you will see that the blue represents US, the yellow represents India, Europe is green, and China is red. And you know, if you look at US, you know, it was nowhere actually 200 years back. But, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, they really start actually having an impact and become the largest economy in the 20th century. And in some sense, 20th century is called, you know, the century that U.S. dominated, or so U.S. century, actually, the world. And you can see that here. And what you will see when you read the history is the first half was about leveraging the second industrial revolution, the coming of automation in factories and things like that. You may have heard about the Ford model of factory creating automobiles and things like that. And the second half is really about taking advantage of introduction of computing, digital technology, etc. And the US, in some sense, dominated the industry sectors in the first half of the 20th century and in the second half of this 20th century across two eras, the second industrial revolution and the third industrial revolution. And now we are actually at the beginning of the fourth industrial revolution. Europe was dominating. In fact, you know, if you look at the first industrial revolution, Britain was the dominating force. And so that's my you know, next slide, which talks about the emergence of superpowers. For quite some time, and this is about 400 years from, let's say, 1600 to 1900, or maybe 1500 to 1900, it's the first industrial revolution, and mass mobilization of people for war was the key competitive advantage, and naval supremacy gave Great Britain the advantage during the first industrial revolution, period of the first industrial revolution. And the countries that had naval supremacy actually dominated the world during the first industrial revolution. The second industrial revolution is, as I said, automation of factories and things like that, ability to mechanize warfare using the use of tanks, trucks, radios, airplane, radar. And towards the end of the second industrial revolution, radar was introduced, atomic bomb was introduced, and United States emerges as the most dominant power. But again, clearly, you know, taking advantage of the ability to mass produce very high-powered machines for warfare was the competitive advantage, and mobilized them to the to use in the war, etc. Actually, at the beginning of the Second World War, beginning of the First World War, Germany had actually dominated in this space, and then there was catch-up between Great Britain, France, and United States and Japan. The third industrial revolution was led by the United States. You know, this is the introduction of computing, etc. And the technologies around materials, around precision guidance using satellites, using computing power to look at how that can be in that can be used to augment the weaponry and things like that. And that's the third industrial revolution, which United States led. And there were structural changes in the organization of military and how it interacted with the rest of the industrial sector and things like that. And we'll come to that. And now we are in the fourth industrial revolution, and several new technologies are being introduced, and we need to figure out how we can leverage these in order to create competitive advantage as an economy, as a military, and things like that. So or early on, the US realized that it needs a separate movement or a separate initiative within the government, and they created the Office of Scientific Research and Development. It worked very closely with private industry because that's the model that US has used in order to do research, innovate, and produce the equipment that's required for military. And so the early part of this 20th century, you know, people talk about the military industrial complex. At the end of the Second World War, there was a relook at this structure, and Vannevar Bush was asked to create a report, and he created the report called Science, the Endless Frontier, which is actually a blueprint for organizing government support for university-based research. Because bulk of the new ideas come from universities and academic institutions, and then they get mobilized to, of course, create the development of the industry, development of the economy, as well as development of military and things like that. This structure allowed US to leverage this really well. Some more details on the next slide, which talks about, so this offset is not the offset that we talk about, which is when we purchase, equipment from outside. There's an offset program where a certain value of the import is actually spent domestically. But this offset is, how do you offset the competitive advantage of a foreign nation leveraging your strengths, actually? And when US looked at at the end of Second World War, how can it offset the strength of numerical power that the enemy has? And US always had actually reluctance to deploy too many people and lose too many people in war and things like that. So how can we quickly win without actually losing too many of our people? And they came out with this atomic weapons and things like that. The second offset strategy started in mid-1970s. And the focus was on guided conventional weapons, and outcome of that is the technology for stealth, global positioning systems, which are now widely used in civilian applications. Every mobile phone has a GPS, every car has a GPS now, and things like that. Computers, networking, etc., came out of the second offset strategy. The third offset strategy started in 2014, where the focus is on unmanned autonomous strike aircraft, unmanned autonomous underwater vehicles, robotics, miniaturization, big data, and realizing that innovation happens faster in the startup ecosystem. There is a specific focus on military's collaboration with innovative private sector companies. And this is, again, very important, because suddenly you realize that it's not just the large enterprises that are innovating. Bulk of the innovations are happening in the startups also. And so let me just give you some glimpses of how the third industrial revolution rolled out, and how US took advantage of that to create competitive advantage. Now, just to I won't go into details, but just show that every year or every 10 years there were innovation. So this was a period of very high amount of innovation, and this continues even today, or in some sense we can say it has accelerated nowadays. And if you look at recently, the Mosaic browser was introduced in 1993, Netscape Navigator in 1994, and this is what made internet very popular. And many of the companies that today have become large enterprises, Amazon, for example, is 25 years old, 26 years old. Google, 23 years old, Facebook, 16 years old. And the convolutional neural network, which is the technology that has made AI and ML very powerful and very popular, was introduced in 2012. And GPUs, the graphical processing units, are the processors that leverage parallel processing in some sense, because they were created for graphics, which required a lot of parallel processing. But now that same technology is being used, parallel processing technology is used for creating neural networks and things like that. And that whole algorithm started that. And now, of course, there are multiple algorithms that can be used for AI ML, started in 2012, less than 8 years back. So we are not actually too far behind, but the significant advances that have happened in the last 10 years. This just shows that, you know, these things have significant impact on the economy. Apple in the last 20 years has gone from $5 billion to $2 trillion. And that's one of the reasons why US is the largest economy in the world. And if you look at the top five companies on the right side, Apple is there, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, which is the parent of Google, Facebook. These are the top five companies in terms of market cap. And Google's market cap is about $2 trillion. India's GDP is about $2.7 trillion. And Apple's Apple's market cap alone is actually more than probably, you know, except for the top 15 or 20 countries in the world. It's larger than, you know, almost 80% of the, or 90% of the countries in the world. And so this has a significant impact on the economy, but it also has an impact on everything else that happens in the economy, including our ability to leverage technology and our ability to put resources for military and things like that. Just a quick look at how long-term planning happens in another part of the world, which is China. China realized that you know, they need to look at AI very strategically, and they created a multi-year plan to say that by 2020, they want to become competitive in AI. 2025, they want to actually create breakthroughs themselves. That means they will leverage AI in application areas like medicine, city infrastructure, manufacturing, agriculture, national defense, to create breakthroughs. That means innovations will come out of that country and become a world leader by 2030, including national defense construction, industrial value chain, and things like that. If you look deeper into that, they actually identified which company will do what. And in an economy like China, it is actually possible to do this, actually. So Baidu will focus on autonomous vehicles, cars, etc. And the commercial use of this technology will actually benefit the defense sector, the military sector. And in China, the boundary between commercial and military, etc., is supposed to be blurred. And hence, you know, you can assume that the same technology will be deployed in military, etc. Alibaba will focus on smart city, Tencent on medical imaging. Again, the same technology can be used to image satellite images and ground cover and military equipment, etc. iFlytek will look at intelligent voice recognition, speech recognition in multiple dialects. Now, this is very important when you think about listening to recorded speeches and things like that in multiple languages. Can you look at automatic translation? Can you look at sentiment analysis? Can you look at annotation? Can you look at which is important from a strategic or a defense or an intelligence perspective, etc.? And SenseTime, which is specializing in facial recognition, which, you know, today it's estimated that with the number of cameras that are deployed across the country, there is no place to hide. You know, if you walk in the street, you will be recognized, actually. And if they want to track you, you can be tracked. The number of papers, I'll go into that. China is now the number one leading in terms of number of papers also. So I gave you a overall view of how emerging technologies impact economies and how emerging technologies through a very careful creation of strategy can be leveraged for creating military superiority and things like that. And AI is a very important technology in that. So let's switch now to emerging technologies. And you need to understand the underlying principles that make these technologies powerful. And that's the reason why I've included this section in my presentation. Multiple new technologies are going to impact all the things that we do, including our lives, our businesses, how governments operate, as well as, of course, how defense works, etc. We'll get into a little bit more details. Now, what is important to realize is that these technologies are happening simultaneously. So you have a multiplier effect, and that's the reason why I focused on emerging technologies. Because when you want to look at big data and want to understand, want to get intelligence out of that, you need AI and ML. Now, if you want to translate a design from a computer to a 3D printer, etc., and translate that design into something that the 3D printer will understand, again, you will use AI and ML. Even in our mobile phones, for example, there is a voice assistant it is helping us actually use the mobile phones better. It can actually understand our speech and things like that. Again, at the back end is AI and ML. So drones, autonomous vehicles, new materials, Internet of Things, all of these are interrelated in some sense or not. And that's the reason why you need to look at it holistically. You need to look at it together. Road to intelligence everywhere. I know this is very, again, understanding what is happening is important. See, when we had mainframe and Vice Admiral A.K. Chawla talked about, the powerful mobile phones that we have, the mainframes which I grew up, 1979 is when I passed out, and my training was on a mainframe at IIT Madras. That mainframe was about $2 million, 256K of memory. But today our mobile phones are, less than $1,000 or sometimes, less than $500, and has probably exponentially more power, 100,000 times more power than the mainframes of yesterday. And in the future, so we have approximately 5-6 billion mobile phones around the world. But in the next 10-20 years, we are going to see Internet of Things, IoT computers, 50 or 60 billion at least deployed across the world. Now, what is a computer? It can take instructions, it can manipulate data, and it can actually come out with outcomes. It can control things. It can capture data. So you have intelligence now dispersed everywhere, ambient intelligence. So every or pervasive computing, right? So everything that we can think of, lights, light switches, or your refrigerator, your coffee machine, anything that you can think of will have a computer embedded in it. It will talk to other computers. It can be managed, controlled, etc. And that's, again, an important technology that is going to change the way we look at things. This is the application of Internet of Things, consumer IoT, connected homes, connected automobiles, wearable technology. Now that's again, going to transform how we as humans interact with computing, because we are automating that interaction in some sense. And going further, when we look at embedded chips, human-computer interface, where our thoughts can be used to direct computers and things to that. And imagine that, you know, you think about something and that something can control something millions, hundreds of thousands of miles away, kilometers away, and change things. And whatever happens there automatically is registered in our mind, memory, etc. Ubiquitous connectivity is extremely important. In India, we are actually at an advantage because we have probably one of the best 4G networks in the world, one of the cheapest telephone networks in the world. You know, nowhere in the world can you get for 399 rupees, almost let's say $4 or $5, unlimited data, unlimited messages, and unlimited voice, actually, practically. So that's amazing coverage that we have, coverage to remote areas, etc. But we need to build broadband connectivity at high bandwidth. That's actually the next innovation that we need to deploy. We need to look at satellite communication covering all parts of the world. And this again, you know, is very, very important when it comes to Navy, because you are middle of the ocean, and how can you get the same unlimited bandwidth, real-time communication to every other part of the world, unless you use satellite communication or some new technologies, etc., that are coming in. Combine this with cloud computing, we get unlimited processing and unlimited storage at very low cost from any part of the world. Now, big data is again important. With all the IoT devices that are being deployed, so much data is going to be generated. Even today, the total amount of data that's being collected is doubling every 2 years. Imagine that. From the beginning of time to now, whatever data is being collected is going to get doubled in the next 2 years. And that will also accelerate as more and more devices are being deployed. Now, how do you make sense of this data without using automated tools? And that's again where AI ML comes in. Now, you already heard about how AI and ML is used to train computers, algorithms, etc. And I'll come to this. But that training requires curated data. That training requires tagging of this data to tell the system, this represents a face, this represents a face of a cat, this represents a face of a dog, etc., etc., if it's a facial recognition system. Unstructured data is more than the structured data. Things like, your purchases, your preferences, things you write in your email, things you talk, all of this actually can then be analyzed using AI and ML sentiment analysis, can be actually redeployed or manipulated to create fake news and things like that. Today, any person can be put into a video, and it's very difficult to figure out whether it's fake or not, actually. And using this, the ability to influence not just one person, entire population, is actually significant worry and significant challenge, actually. And in some sense, as our life becomes more and more digital, crime becomes more and more digital, non-state actors become the enemy. Of course, state actors will continue, but non-state actors also can actually use the power of technology to actually influence countries and things like that. So now I will get deeper into AI and ML or the next 2-3 slides. Now, why is AI ML powerful? Why is it actually very different from computing that we know about? See, traditional computing, what does it do? you look at a problem, you look at how that can be solved, and that's the algorithm that you create, and you feed the data and out comes the result. But the model, the pedagogy that's used is you understand the problem, you know how to solve the problem, then you convert that into an algorithm, you convert that into a program, feed it into the computer, and the computer executes that program instruction by instruction. It strictly follows the program that is fed into. If the program has an error, the computer will produce error as output. And the data is then fed in to create the result. So in some sense, you need to know how to solve the problem if you want to use this methodology of solving problems. And this limited our use of digital computers to the problems that we know how to solve. So where did we apply this? We applied this in automating business processes because we were executing business processes. We used it to automate stuff that we knew how to do. And that's what limited our use of digital computer in the past. Whereas AI/ML actually flips this on its head, actually. So you have now curated data. This sample data is used to train the system, and you actually feed in the desired result. So in the example that I talked about, so your desired result is that you need to create a system that recognizes men and their faces. So very clearly, we want to recognize adult male and their faces actually is what we want to recognize. Then in a sample data, you will actually have lots and lots of pictures. In those, you will actually have pictures of other types of faces. You will have faces of women, etc. But then you will tag faces of men as the as a particular, with a particular tag. And the computer recognizes this and figures out an algorithm to get you the desired results, actually. So you are training the computer to recognize male faces. Next, when the algorithm is fed back into the system and you give a new data, it immediately recognizes a male face, actually. Facial recognition is one of the areas where, or pattern recognition, where AI/ML has been used extensively, and the accuracy can be as high as 97-98%, and it will never forget a face also. So that's why this is very, very powerful when you think about, actually. And so, this paradigm is very different because you didn't know, and we can't write a program to using the traditional model to actually solve this problem of recognizing male faces, actually. Because we don't know ourselves how, as humans, we recognize faces. We do not know how to do that. There are very, crude models that are available. But with AI/ML, now the accuracy is 97-98%. And the computer has become far superior to humans in recognizing faces. And it can recognize millions of faces and identify millions of people, actually. Almost instantaneously if you have a very powerful computer. And so this model of computing is very different from the model that we had traditionally. And this is what is changing the face of computing now. And this is called artificial narrow intelligence because you train the system to do one task and one task better and better over time. Now, the history of machine, use of machines, augmenting human capabilities with machines is that, and this is from time, beginning of time, actually, when humans came into this world from the beginning, we become much and much better than machines over time. So let me take transportation, right? Initially we used animals to move, then we invented vehicles, then we invented internal combustion engine, cars and things like that. Then we invented flights. Of course, in between, we figured out how to travel on sea and things like that. But over time, we can actually transport hundreds of thousands of people in a single vehicle, and let's say look at the A380, you know, 600 people almost at the speed of light from place A to place B. So over time, when we focus on something, we become far superior to human capabilities in the task that we select. Numerical computation, another example. Remembering things, again, another example, right? Where the machines have become far superior over time in doing something simple. Search and retrieval, right? All the knowledge that is there, which is fed into the internet, is now available at our fingertips. Facial recognition. Now, what is our learning from this? Machines don't need to replicate humans. We always create new designs and models. So when you look at flight, for example, you know, nature has movable wings. You know, birds have movable wings. But when we initially tried movable wings, we realized that it doesn't somehow work. It's not efficient. And we figured out that fixed wings and a thrust at the back, you know, using a jet engine or a propeller, etc., would be what moves things faster. And we came up with designs which are very different from how nature has done things. And that is why I believe that, over time, of course, machines become better than humans, but over time, a network of machines will become far more intelligent than humans. And that's why I believe that we will achieve artificial general intelligence, that is replicating capabilities of humans using a collection of machines over time. These are new classes of problems that can be solved. And this is why this is called intelligence revolution. I will not go into, each one of these, but it's all the things that we can now do, which changes the way, converse, right? If we can actually have speech recognition, natural language processing, and real-time translation combined together, I could be speaking to you in English, and automatically this could be translated in real time into Hindi for people to hear, or any other language for people to hear simultaneously or in real time, and so on. Actually, so there are multiplicity of applications that are possible now, including autonomous vehicles and things like that, which allows us to combine multiple things. It again uses pattern recognition. It uses recognition of objects, commands it recognizes, it looks at other vehicles that are there, it communicates with these other vehicles in the road, and moves from place A to place B. Drones, again, you can give GPS coordinates and it figures out how to go there without detection, etc. And so many new applications are possible, which uses quote unquote intelligence, which is intelligence that we have recreated using machines. Very briefly, now I will get into AI, applicability of AI in the naval context. And when you look at, using something, the application that you're going to put to, I found a very interesting analysis that has been done, which looks at six different parameters. The speed of decision making, which is very, very important, because the current technology requires probably a high powered computing, which is at a different location, may not be available at the edge. It may require communication, high speed communication to that central location. So speed of decision making is extremely important to look at what algorithms, what AI thing will use. The heterogeneity and volume of data is very important. You need to have sample data, and there are now AI algorithms where you can use sparse data. But again, so the volume of data and the heterogeneity of data is also very important when you look at deploying AI. Quality of the data links is very important. If you have a link that is intermittent, etc., then you need to think about localizing some of the decision making using AI. The complexity of the action, where the possibility of, see, AI is still not completely debugged or completely made foolproof, right? So depending on the data that you feed in, the algorithm is complete or not complete. So you must have read about the first use of facial recognition. The computer actually recognized people of color, black people, etc., as gorillas or something like that, right? You must have read about that. Why? Because the data that was used to train the computer were all white Anglo-Saxon people. And so when the computer saw somebody, a person of color, thought that it is actually not a human, right? So complexity of action, the quality of the data, the danger of the mission. So you will not deploy something that is not fully tested into something that is highly critical, etc., until you have completely debugged it, and the required persistence and endurance. Though machines have endurance, it's about the persistence and the ability of the AI system to manage this because of the connectivity and things like that. And here are some set of applications that naval missions are looking at, which to me, application is kind of obvious, but the complexity comes in do you have the sample data, do you have the ability, just look at the previous slide, ability to deploy this for this application, and do you have the the computing power, the connectivity and things like that in order to address this problem. Clearly, most of these are about deploying it in the battlefield. Of course, it can also be used. And so I have another cut at this. What could be the applications that can be used? So it can be used for administrative purposes, and probably these are actually a very good way to get people familiar with, as well as get some productivity, processing of emails, invoices, automating administrative tasks, this whole area of robotic process automation, RPA, is where some of these things are coming. Traditional business process automation used people, whereas now we are actually deploying automation and AI for business processes and things like that. AI for organizing, writing, disseminating correspondence. Now AI can be used to summarize articles, translate articles, even actually write stories and things like that, poetry. Personal assistant for scheduling meetings, planning purposes, knowledge management, answer hypothetical questions based on past data and past actions, risk management, financial planning, logistics and infrastructure management, predictive maintenance, which was mentioned again, interfacing with global supply and logistical systems so that you can automate the supply chains, crisis response. So categorizing social media messages, categorizing conversations, etc., sentiment analysis, etc. Again, a very important application of AI and machine learning. Mapping tools to create a common comprehensive picture. See, one of the areas where AI does very well is pattern recognition and things like that, if the machine can be trained properly. Training, again, a very important application, because the machine actually can be used to actually track progress and things like that. Then it comes to intelligence gathering, intelligence creating intelligence, force protection and force structure also. So you can see that there's multiplicity of applications, And it is only limited to our imagination. Is science fiction becoming reality today? And that's why this technology is so powerful. And I also talked about the paradigm shift in the difference between digital computers and AI machine learning systems, why it's a fundamental horizontal technology that will affect everything that we do, and we can do them better, faster, cheaper, with less fatigue, less error and things like that, provided we are able to train the machine properly. And it becomes better and better as time goes on because it has more data. Now, quickly, I will talk about how do you combine all this to create a strategy. And this is my perspective, which probably requires a lot of discussion. But this strategy I came up with this based on understanding of history and understanding, you know, the offset program in the US, etc., and how they leveraged the entire stakeholder ecosystem to create that advantage. And that's what, you know, I'm saying we need to think about. First of all, we need to think about the strategic capabilities to build. Very, very important to make few bets. And this becomes very important because we have to look at our neighborhood, our situation, and figure out what are the strategic capabilities we need to build. You know, it's very similar to US looked at and said, we can't have numerical superiority, so we need to go to atom bomb. We can't deploy people on the ground, so let's go to guided and robotic technology and things like that. So I can sit safely at a different place. Of course, this is applicable to everybody, but I'm just saying that's the thinking that drove some of the things that they did. And we need to think about what strategic capabilities to build, then identify partner. The partner ecosystem is extremely important. And I will come to a little bit more details in the next slide, actually. Identify and secure supply chain. This is, again, very, very important. For example, this whole competition that's going on between US and China, in some sense, is about actually crippling the electronics industry in China because they don't have access to the chips now, which are underlying. Most of the chips are actually manufactured in Taiwan today for the entire world. And the entire world is dependent on the chip manufacturing in Taiwan. And Taiwan becomes then hugely strategic, not just to US, but to China, to the rest of the world also. We need to think about build versus buy. Long-term patient capital commitment is required because these are multi-year commitments, sometimes multi-decade commitments, actually. And something that starts in a lab will take probably 10, 20 years before it's deployed in the field, etc. Because we are talking about AI, we need to have access to relevant large data sets. They need to be curated. They need to be tagged, which is, again, a very human intensive task, and then use it to train the systems. Sandboxes to test the new systems, extremely important, because we don't want to deploy something that is not being tested in a secure facility, secure area, and things like that, where mistakes can be not very costly. High-speed communication technology for high-sea operations, I talked about. Model for deploying the new capabilities. Again, you know, the model is, again, very, very important. I'll just give you a brief example very quickly. When you think about MRI, you know, magnetic resonance imaging technology, and the traditional thinking, linear extrapolation, is to create more powerful magnets, you know, 3 Tesla to 7 Tesla. So as you can look at one single cell and things like that. But a non-linear thinking is, can I deploy AI and ML and augment an image which is taken in a 1.5 Tesla machine and amplify it to get 3 Tesla clarity or high definition of a 3 Tesla machine. So what happens now? The equipment is probably 1/10 expensive because as every Tesla increase is 10 times more expensive, but you create that capability at a very low cost. And so the model for deploying these capabilities are extremely important. Training programs for using these new capabilities is very important, because that again has to be planned. If ultimately people do not understand and can't use these technologies, we can't deploy them. Just focusing on partnerships, we need to build trusted long-term relationships, because see, you have to fund the research, the innovation, the deployment. All these are risky, because every research area does not become a product, and so there will be there will be money that may not actually result in the short term, at least, into products and technology that can be used, etc. So you need to actually have the ability to work with partners over the long period of time, so that they can actually work on the research, they can actually innovate, etc. Academic partnerships are very important, both for the research side as well as continuing education, as well as to actually attract talent. Because that again is, I think, very, very important as we become more digital, as we become more dependent on technology. Working with startup ecosystem is very important. Innovations happen in the startup ecosystem because the startup ecosystem uses risk funding. So if you're a traditional company, you are managed very differently. The ability to take risk is limited. So the ability to look at R&D, etc., is very different. Whereas if you are a startup, you use risk funding to do the R&D, and hence you can actually reduce the cost as well as the risk. So working with startups is very important. And strategic global partnerships with the other ecosystems, be it, let's say, a country like Israel or US or any other country, becomes very, very important. And we need to select partners properly. We need to make sure that our dependencies are mapped properly, so that we can depend on these partnerships in a crisis, etc. So in summary, I talked about the big picture. I talked about the programs that are required at the national level to create competitive advantage. And with the competitive advantage today, you can actually create moats around you, such that people can't actually catch up soon. Then we talked about actually specific technologies and why these technologies are actually very powerful, very important. They are paradigm shifts, and pervasive computing, or the paradigm shift to AI and ML, where now we can use a machine to do intelligent tasks which we humans actually did not know how to do it. We can't express how we do it. Then we briefly looked at some applications. And the bottom line here is it can actually impact everything. So we need to make choices. We need to look at what we want to deploy initially, what time frames we want to use it. And lastly, we looked at a strategy around this, in terms of which applications, with which partnership, with what time frame. I think that kind of a multi-year plan is required. So thank you all very much. I will stop sharing, and we will probably have a few minutes for Q&A. So I will just go through some of the questions that are coming.
Sir, thank you, sir, for the enlightening the audience with insights, sir. Sir, may we have certain questions and answers from the audience, sir?
Before, sure, go ahead.
I will also request the audience that if they have any questions, they may type it in the Q&A tab in the left sidebar. Sir, we have a question from Commander Mridul Pandey. Yes. Sir, I will read it out, sir. As brought by you, emerging technologies such as IoT, wearable tech, connected homes, NLP, face recognition, etc., most of them require online support. Connectivity as a paramount requirement. However, when it comes to defense application, a key parameter is offline capability, captive solutions, in-premise developed applications with recurrent learning. So Commander Mridul Pandey would like to know your views on how we can achieve a midway between the connectivity paradigm being a key in development and constraints in deployment.
So one, you know, we need to have very different architectures at the edge. Edge is where, you know, in the field and things like that. Today, you can actually create very powerful computers at the edge and bundle the learning algorithms, bundle these algorithms into even hardware such that it can be deployed in the field. You know, it's really surprising that you can get multi-terabyte storage and you know, gigahertz of processing on a smartphone, right? So it is possible to do this. So, you know, today you can actually Google Translate, for example, you can completely do offline for a symbol for a particular language. What happens is the algorithm has been created in a lab with lots of data, and then it's encapsulated and downloaded onto the edge. So there is technique and technology that's available. So it has to be done in a planned manner, but it is possible to do this today for certain applications. Now, certain applications may require coordination across and real-time data from multiple locations. Their connectivity is still very important. Next question. Hello.
To become a leader in AI.
Can you repeat that? I didn't hear it fully.
So the question is, what model should India adopt to leverage our inherent advantages in IT to become a world leader in AI?
So, you know, what is interesting is that most of the systems that are developed around the world, including design of hardware, there is an element of Indian intelligence in that, in the sense that this R&D is done in India. The design is done in India. We have the second largest technology manpower in the world. And so a lot of this work is actually getting done in India, but in multinational labs of multinational corporations where the full knowledge is not with us, but partial knowledge is with us. So probably, for example, if you take a processor chip, you know, maybe 60% is done here, 40% is done elsewhere. So what is needed is we need to create an ecosystem for us to leverage this knowledge. To some extent, it is happening in the startups. So you are seeing now startups that are becoming global, startups that are competing with global multinationals coming out of India. And this is a result of the knowledge that we have created in these individuals, captured in these individuals of working with global companies. And now they are creating startups that compete with these global multinationals out of India. And we have a very large market. So these will see commercial applications in India. The second, and this is where I think there is some work required, we need to actually increase the amount of R&D spending. See, our R&D spending is about 0.7% of GDP today. And now, first of all, our GDP is only $2.7 trillion, so 0.7% of that. Whereas US or China is $13 trillion, US is about $19 trillion, and they spend 2 to 3% of GDP. So you can imagine the money that they're spending on R&D is significantly higher than the money that we spend on R&D. Of course, our people costs are lower, but still the equipment cost is the same. So we need to actually spend a lot more on R&D. We need to pick and choose. Again, that's why I said we need to pick and choose the areas that we want to focus on, and then have mission mode programs. And I'm very glad that AI is being chosen, but we need to go one level below that by looking at, is it pattern recognition, satellite imagery, the question that you asked about, can we invest in technology that can be deployed at the edge at power that we require, etc. So we need to invest in R&D very strategically in order to make the R&D pay. Next question, please.
Sir, we have a lot of questions pouring in, and before I go for further questions, sir, I would be requesting Flag Officer Commanding Chief, Southern Naval Command, to express his views, and if he has desires to ask a question with the speaker.
Sure. Thank you.
Provided us in terms of AI, and particularly the last part was extremely interesting to us, how it is applicable in the naval field and the defense domain in general. So it was indeed very enlightening, and you provided us a lot of food for thought. One question that I had was that, we have over the last few years, particularly the Southern Naval Command, since we are a training command, engaged in a lot of MOUs with Academia, which you mentioned as one of the foundational reasons for the United States to improve in various aspects of technology. And as you would be aware, in Germany they have this beautiful triumvirate of Academia, industry and the government, which sort of works in is supposed to be the best model in the world. So while we have a lot of MOUs, my question is that from your experience, how do you think we can better design and leverage MOUs, particularly for AI and related emerging technologies, to your advantage?
So I have been working with the research ecosystem, academic research ecosystem, in the last 6-7 years after I stepped down from Infosys. And the initial observations is that most of the research is very small. It happens between one professor, maybe 2-3 PhD students or postdocs. Their funding is typically 10 lakhs, 20 lakhs, not very ambitious. And what happens is they publish a paper and forget about it, because their metric, their performance metric, is how many papers you published. And so everybody is happy in the academic arena. I think we need to come out with mission mode programs, more ambitious programs. So can we create a vehicle, right? Can we create autonomous underwater vehicle which can be deployed miles and miles from the coast, right? So things like that, create very ambitious goals. And then so these are large programs, multidisciplinary programs. Identify partners, get them to work together towards that objective, and at some point engage with industry so that the translational work also can start and industry starts producing this, either for military applications and at a later stage commercial applications. Israel does this very well. In fact, they go further, because every citizen goes through military 3 years or something like that in the military, and then they come back to civilian work. So they go for higher studies after doing their military stint, etc. So that ecosystem, that kind of thing, we need to think about. So can we actually attract students to become scholarship holders, continue to do research, they will then come and engage with the Navy, large programs, things like that. I think there has to be further thought into these MOUs. Are they just a very broad area? Do they have an objective in terms of a resulting technology that can be deployed, etc.? I feel that it requires more discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Sir, we have one more question from Rear Admiral C.S. Baburaj.
Yes.
So in India, the concerns of privacy and confidentiality are just emerging. Do you see these concerns growing with time, with AI becoming more involved in our working?
Yes, definitely. You know, our life today depends on the data that is being collected by everybody, including government, and decisions that are made based on that data. And many a time that those decisions in the future will be made by machines rather than humans, actually. So we do not know what data is collected. We do not know what is the quality of the data. We do not know the quality of the algorithms that are being used to make decisions about us. We do not know whether the data is being misused, shared with other people, etc. And this whole area is actually very, very important as we go forward. We need rules and regulations around these things so that we know what to expect. Privacy is gone. You know, it's very, very clear that there is no privacy anymore. So what we need is actually a set of regulations that bring predictability to some extent and creates a deterrent for misuse. Because that's all we can now hope for. That is, we need to prevent misuse of our data, because for services that we desire, we are willing to share data, but only for the services that we desire. And that's the key, phrase there. So we need to have very clear regulations around the use of data, deterrent for misuse of data, giving power to the citizens to understand, recall. For example, you know, suppose I say you need to delete all this data about me, I need to have an assurance that it will be deleted and it will not be misused. All of this. So this is a whole area where the entire world is actually struggling with, and you will see lots of new regulations that are coming. India is also in the forefront of discussing these things. I'm personally involved in the non-personal data recommendations. Actually, I chair that committee for Government of India, and this is something which I believe will be very important going forward for giving people the confidence and the trust that their data will not be misused.
Sir, we will be taking, although there are multiple questions pouring in from the audience, but we will take this one last question. Sure. This is from Captain P.P. Singh. How relevant would it be for the Navy to have its own private cloud service? And how practical would it be to roll out in quick time, given the dispersed nature of naval units?
See, I strongly believe that for military applications, you need to have a private cloud for creating redundancy, for creating resilience. That is, there is no single point of failure. It could be by Navy, Air Force, etc., or it could be within Navy itself. Multiple cloud services. I think it's very, very important to have resiliency built into it, robustness built into it, for military applications, I strongly believe that private data, cloud data is the way to go. You can use partners to build them. So the technology is something that you will leverage from partners, but the deployment architecture will be private. That means you are not storing your data on a public cloud, especially, national security related and things like that. See, there is no place that is secure. Everything can be decrypted. Everything can be hacked in. So you need to have your own private cloud. So the probability reduces significantly.
Thank you, sir. I would like to formally thank you for enlightening the audience with insights into emerging technologies and their relevance for Indian Navy. Surely, it has introduced us to new paradigms of technology with a much wider perspective.